it up for questions. Why don't we go ahead and continue this conversation for a few minutes between the panelists? So let me give each of the panelists a few minutes to respond to the previous comments, beginning with Professor Postel.
Okay, so there was a lot to respond to in Professor Grieve's remarks, but I just want to fix on what I think is the most important thing, which is what do you really mean by strong parties? A, don't we really have strong parties already? And B, assuming we don't, what would Postel do to create them? I think the answer to the first part of that question is no, we do not have strong parties. We have the appearance of strong parties without the actual substance. So the one thing you can guarantee about Republicans and Democrats is that they will vote against the other party. But you can never it's very difficult to understand what they will vote for. So the phenomenon of negative partisanship in which Republicans don't feel very good about their own party, but they really feel united in hatred for the other party. And of course, vice versa. Democrats don't really like their own party, but they really hate the other party. That sort of forms the basis of unity of the two parties today, which means that they're not really parties that are situated well for governing. They're only parties that are really well situated for vetoing the decisions by the other party to the best of their ability. They're opposition parties. Even the majority party is a sort of opposition party. It's just a temporary majority united in its opposition to the previous party rule. So the two sort of factors people focus on to show that we have strong parties are party voting in Congress, which is, of course, done entirely on a partisan basis, and then voter behavior, which is straight ticket voting, right, as opposed to the split ticket voting and divided government we used to have. The difficulty is that when you start to look within a party, depending on whether it's, say, an R25 district versus like an R+2 district, that pretty much explains where they disagree with each other. So you have factions inside each party that don't do a very good job of uniting within them. So I think one of the best analyses of this that I've read recently is by a fellow named Daniel Schlossman at Johns Hopkins. The metaphor he uses is we have hollow parties. The hollow parties is the title of this article. And essentially, we have voters who don't really feel any connection to parties. They feel connections to individual candidates, but not to parties. The only connection they feel to their party is through these candidates. The candidates use the labels of the parties, but they don't really have any loyalty to the party as an organization. And so the party organizations themselves are completely deteriorating, right? Go to any small county. You go to any sort of rural county in America and look for the party. It's sort of usually they're in these decrepit, sort of downtown office buildings. There might be a person who shows up every once in a while to take phone calls. But look at the candidate operations and look at the amount of money that's being spent outside the parties, right? The real organization in American politics is done extra party, not intra party. And maybe this gets to then what my solution would be, which I think at the most fundamental level is to rebuild meaningful connections between local parties and national parties. Essentially, this is a problem of organization. And that's a very vague proposal, but I think it's the only proposal that will work in the long run. People need to see that instead of, say, temporarily uniting to help a candidate get elected, and then thinking that they've done the work that they've needed once that candidate got elected, join a party that represents a sort of broader set of principles and a long-standing organization for the advancement of those principles. By the way, this is a sort of imbalance on right and left on this point. The left is really good at community organizing. We know that, right? The right doesn't do community organizing. It doesn't organize. It doesn't think institutionally. And I think that's my broadest proposal. As far as the specific proposals, abolish primaries, you're right that that's probably an unrealistic goal. It is 100% a goal that I would favor. And I think that would do a lot of good. Inside Congress, the last thing you suggest, like the revival of the committees, I am deeply concerned about the revival of committee government. So typically, this is the proposal on the right to fix Congress. Bring power back to committees. John Dingell is what we want. What did John Dingell do? Right? He represented the Detroit automakers in iron triangles where he formed associations between the administrative state and his interest groups that were in his district so that he could funnel the benefits of the administrative state to his own constituents. I think that the committee system in Congress was basically a model for capture of the administrative state by organized interests. And so I'm fearful that if we just revived committees, then the people who get on the ag committees would do so in order to funnel USDA policies for the benefit of their constituents, and so on and so forth. So if you revive the committees, you have to have them organized and governed on a partisan basis. The appointments have to be for the good of the party, not the good of the constituencies represented by the members who want to be on those committees. Christopher DeMuth has written a lot about this, and he has this way of formulating it. He thinks there needs to be a much greater partisan and committee control over Congress. But partisan not meaning from the top down, where the party leaders just impose their will on the rank and file members, rather like a bottom-up system in which the party leaders truly reflect the views of the rank and file. So those would be some areas that I'd want to go to revive a more functional party system in Congress.
I yield to no one in my admiration for tailpipe Johnny Dingell. All right. So long as he was in Congress, the EPA couldn't go insane. Now that he's gone and the committee has fallen apart, the EPA is a menace to the free world. That's one thing. Joe, I am so sympathetic to so much of what you have to say. I just think it's unrealistic. So one of my intellectual mentors was James Q. Wilson. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jim Wilson of Harvard and then Pepperdine fame, who in the 1960s, the early 1960s, wrote about the rise of the amateur in politics, right? What Joe wants to celebrate is local politicians who are sort of basically good at what they do, all right? Because they're in the business of politics, as distinct from people who have an iPhone or, you know, some idiotic thingy that allows you to build a movement. It's the rise of the amateur for two related reasons, it seems to me. One is sort of what Jim Wilson called the threshold of concern in politics has gone down. We expect politicians, Congress, our legislatures to do an awful lot, okay? Educate our children. What can a senator actually do about that? The answer is nothing. But they're not allowed to say, I can't do anything about it. They have to say, oh yeah, we'll take care of that. right? And if that's the expectation, if that's the horizon of expectations, all that Congress can really do is hand over the entire business to these sort of mini legislatures in the administrative state, and everybody has their own agency and you know, go to town on it. And the other thing is that the costs of political organization have gone down so much that everybody now can demand everything in an instant, right? I mean, once upon a time, you wanted to help minorities in this country. You had to build the NAACP. That's a real organization with members who show up at offices, who pay attention, who pay dues, who, you know, get organized in a real way, right? That's not the way the world works anymore. I mean, Black Lives Matter, that's a website or whatever it is. I mean, I don't use these things, right? You can organize that in an instant, right? And the political system at some point has to respond to that. And it's inconceivable to me that in that environment, you can actually rebuild real live organizations that take, you know, real blood and sweat to build.
All right. Now's the part where you all get to participate. I will remind you, we've had a number of questions already come in, but you have the ability to do so by going to slido.com and entering hashtag S22TPS. I see the queue already forming. I will go ahead and take the moderate prerogative and ask the first question. Assuming that we agree on the solution of empowering parties, how is it we should do that specifically vis-a-vis campaign finance? And so the hypothesis I will throw out to the panel is, if you actually take a look at what has happened to parties and their strength in recent decades, probably the greatest impact came from the combination of the Citizens United and Speech Now cases, which created much more ability for outside groups to have disproportionate impact, swamping the ability of parties. Parties are much more constrained under the current system of campaign finance. And most, I think, of the individuals in this room would hail those prior decisions as good for the political process. So what would be the solution for parties given that construct?
Yeah, so I think the solution that both works for constitutional government and for the specific purpose here is to just allow parties to compete on par with super PACs. So we have a campaign finance system that caps donations and amounts and expenditures by parties, but doesn't do so by so-called independent expenditures. So given that situation, we should just abolish all of the caps on gifts to parties and expenditures by parties, and then let people send their money to parties. That won't solve the problem itself, because people may not want to send their money to the party rather than through an independent group, but at least this would be a step in the right direction. That's my view. Yep.
All right. So now, having seen the queue, I will give my standard admonitions with regard to asking questions. Number one, take a look down at the program for today's panel. If you do not see your name listed, then you are not a speaker. And so your role...
That was very good.
Your role, then, is to ask a question. Now, it sometimes takes a lawyer to explain simple words like question. What is a question? This isn't a metaphysical question. This is a basic one. So let me give you a few hints on what a question is. Generally speaking, it is a grouping of sentences no more than, say, three. I'll allow them to be compound complex. At the end of this series of sentences, there should be a question mark. Now, that's hard to tell when someone is speaking. An indication oftentimes is your voice will go up because you're anticipating a response from someone else. There are also fake questions such as, here's my speech, do you agree? So with those admonitions, Ovik, I'll let you lead off.
Thank you, Robert. I'll do my best. Interesting remarks. Thank you both for your comments. Joe, I just wanted to touch on one thing you said earlier, where you said conservatives love policy but not politics. Is that really true? Question mark. Because what I observe is that conservatives love politics. They love to talk about presidential races, midterms, the culture war meme of the moment on Fox News. They love to talk about catchphrases like Constitution and limited government. They actually don't like to talk about the details of public policy, like how to reform the healthcare system or how to reform the administrative state. And therefore, they can't actually compromise with their opponents because they don't have the ability to dial things up and dial things down in a legislative compromise. Yeah. Do you agree? Question mark.
Mostly don't agree. So, but maybe it's just when I say they don't like politics, what I mean is not that they don't like elections, and especially presidential elections and culture war fights over social media. That's not politics, right? I'm thinking of politics in a very old school sense of people who get together the way senators used to get together and each gives a little bit in order to advance causes that they can find some agreement on. That clearly is not what the right is interested in these days. So that's what I mean by politics. And I think on that, conservatives do not like politics.
I'll just say one thing. I don't know whether this is in defense of the administrative state or anything, but it's just an observation. Sometimes we underestimate the rationality that can actually be had in politics. So during the Trump administration, there was all that drama, constant drama at the White House, right? All that huffing and blowing, all that circus. Meanwhile, a lot of the agencies were run by really competent people. I mean, Kathy Kraninger, you know, it was a good thing. Mercifully, all of that stayed under the radar. Right. We did a lot of good things. What you now have is sort of the Trump administration in reverse, which is, oh, I'm a moderate, I'm an adult at the White House. Meanwhile, the agencies are run by insane people. These people are crazy, okay? And we can't have that. So, I mean, the FTC, give me a break, right? This is not to disagree or agree with Joe on anything, but it's really important what goes on at that level of politics. And much as I am in favor of saying, okay, it would be good to have a Congress that actually has a budget. It would be good to have a Congress that actually says, wait a minute, you can't just spend $1 trillion that we've never appropriated on student loan forgiveness. It would be good to have that, okay? At the same time, it really matters at a day-to-day level who runs these agencies and how they behave.
Yeah. All right.
Sorry, that was a diatribe. Exclamation mark.
Thank you. Our next question will come from one of our Slido participants. Jason Jewell asks, why does Professor Postel not include federalism as a strategy for reining in the administrative state, especially if SCOTUS reconsiders Chevron?
I'd have to think more about the relationship between an abolition of Chevron and federalism. I suppose that's a lot of water. A lot of what I'm trying to do is also water under the bridge, as Michael has pointed out. But federalism, I think the prospects for a genuine revival of federalism are remote, because there's been a lot of water under the bridge there. What we have today is a kind of faux federalism with so-called cooperative federalism in environmental law, which is one of my favorite euphemisms for the federal government makes the rules and the states carry them out. And I don't see a sufficient, as far as politics goes, I think states, let's put it this way, if you have a revival of parties, you have a revival of federalism, because the parties I'm talking about are parties that are rooted in state and local interests. So the parties were synonymous with federalism in the 19th century. There was no RNC and DNC that drew, that sort of had all of the money and dictated measures from on high. The party system was decentralized, which is why you could have Texas Democrats and Massachusetts Democrats who disagreed on almost everything call themselves Democrats, because it was essentially a state party system. So I suppose the way back to federalism, sorry to sort of, say parties are the solution to everything, but the solution to the problem of federalism is also parties, because if you have genuine parties, then you have a genuine state-based kind of structure.
Thank you. My name is Daniel Lowenstein. I'm an emeritus law professor at UCLA, now directing a center called the Center for the Liberal Arts and Free Institutions. Trying to condense this. Political scientists have, since V.O. Key at least, seen parties as multifold, not unitary organizations. Key divided them between the party and the government, the party and the party organization, and the party and the electorate. I think that for purposes of the questions that particularly Professor Postrel is raising, one actually has to go much deeper into the weeds than that and look at how the parties function in different procedures and all different kinds of ways in Congress and outside. So if you agree with that, here's the question. Will doing that, getting really detailed into how things might work better, do you think that will make it easier or more difficult to work out some of the problems that I think your discussion with each other indicates exists when we deal with it at the level of abstraction that you're dealing with it?
Mm-hmm, right. I think it would make things easier in the sense that the decisions would be, it's tough for the public to follow those kinds of things closely. And one of the problems we have in American politics today is too much transparency, and too little space for people to make decisions without demagoguery and sort of rhetoric immediately coming in and blowing up any kind of agreement that can be reached. So, you know, it's no coincidence that Congress went into, you know, precipitous decline right around the time that C-SPAN showed up to committee hearings and on the floor. This has been well documented, right, that transparency has the opposite effect. It tends to actually make popular government much more difficult rather than easier. And so if you have these kinds of very complicated, say, delegate allocation sort of rules and candidate selection rules being made at, like, local and state levels by committees, I still think those things will be followed pretty closely, but I think that's one place where insiders can have some space to make the kinds of decisions that would help contribute to a more well-functioning system.
Can I just add one thing to that? I was tempted to sort of bring this up earlier, but this is a very fine time to do it. This goes back to James Madison. If you ask Mr. Madison, the great little man, what is it that makes you hopeful that Congress can actually deliberate? He would say, it's a big country. We want a big country. That means big electoral districts. What that means is that only the worthiest people can be elected. Okay? Read Federalist 14, 15. That's where that is. The argument, it's political scientists call this filtration, right? That was his theory. It now sounds insane to us and vaguely elitist, but it was very, very important to the founders, okay? And then James Madison gets elected to the House of Representatives, and he writes this despondent letter to Thomas Jefferson and says, I cannot believe this. All these pigs came crawling out of the woodwork and managed to get elected, okay? And what that has to do with this is he wanted agency slack, right? You cannot responsibly deliberate and legislate unless you have some sort of slack between the voters and your representatives. Hopefully not too much slack because it can be abused, but some, right? And under modern conditions, that has just disappeared. And that makes it, because every legislator is monitored 24/7, right? And that just makes them play to the crowd and to Fox TV or MSNBC, and you're dead.
Yep.
Not dead yet, but getting there.
All right, next question from Slido, from Professor Lee Strang. Are the problems with congressional governance also caused by the expansion of congressional power over all aspects of America, including subjects that are too complex for it?
So I have some hope that that's not the case. I think the era of national government sort of expanding into new areas of regulation like workplace safety, child labor, food safety, that was done for a while in American history and could still be done today by legislators who aren't experts. That's why you need a committee system, that's why you need staff, and you need to sort of build up Congress's capacity. But I think Congress is better built to manage those things than one person in the White House who can't possibly know all of the things necessary to govern the bureaucracy. So I mean, I think you can make the argument that members of Congress should use their committees to gain that kind of expertise, that kind of specialization, which would mean they should be in those committee spots for a while. You know, Republicans embrace the idea of term limits for committee chairs as a way of kicking them out, you know, sort of keeping the concentration of power in Congress from becoming acute, but then that actually sort of weakened Congress, its ability to gather that kind of expertise. So I think Congress can actually amass that kind of expertise and deploy it effectively, probably more so than one person in the White House. That's my suspicion.
Morton.
Yes, I'm Morton Blackwell. I happen to be the Republican National Committee man of Virginia. I've served in that position now since 1988. Political parties in the United States are very different from political parties elsewhere in the world. In other countries, the parties are in fact unitary and powerful. They can control who is a member of the party. They can charge dues. They can throw people out of the party. None of that is true in the United States.
Right.
We have parties here that have developed into a Madisonian model for party organization. People think that the Republican National Committee runs the party. That isn't true. It raises hundreds of millions of dollars and decides how to spend it, but you've got the National Republican Senatorial Committee, the National Republican Congressional Committee, the Republican Governors Association, the Hispanic Republican Assembly, the Young Republicans, Women's Republicans, College Republicans, and they're all independent of each other. There's no control or no overriding umbrella where the Republican National Committee cannot tell the College Republicans what to do. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions as to some mechanism by which this diverse Madisonian model that the Republican Party operates under could be converted into a centralized party that has unity and control over everything that says it is Republican.
Over to you.
I mean, I think you've very nicely contrasted why American parties are weak compared to, say, other parliamentary systems with much stronger party systems. I actually would hesitate before creating that kind of centralized unitary party system. Yeah, okay. So I want strong parties that are not run from the top down, but rather build from the bottom up. And so you need some sort of place, like a convention. I mean, this is all just in American history. We just have to go back and look at it. You need a convention where they're all forced to come from their own states, where they come in with the little signs where they're, you know, their state delegates, and then they're forced to make decisions on like a platform and on candidates. And that infrastructure was built, and it worked, I think, much better than the one we have now. So I'd try to replicate that as much as possible, which is much more decentralized. Not in the way you're suggesting, which is a bunch of autonomous organizations with no coordinating mechanism, but rather a decentralized system with some coordinating body that represents the pluralism and the diversity of all of the different parts of the party. That seems to me to be the right balance between unity and diversity inside a party.
All right.
Yeah, I'm Robert Geminer of Methodist University, and the more issues you have, the harder it is to get agreement. And I never see political parties articulating positions on all the things the administrative state is doing. So my question is, can we rein in the bureaucracy without simultaneously reining in the scope of what government in general and specifically the federal government does? And might it be better to rely on the courts to say you can't do that anymore?
I have I think I'm more optimistic about the courts than Joe is. I totally agree that you can't really rely on I mean, the courts. That'll reign in the administrative state. That's ludicrous, right? Administrative law, I'm telling you, is the law of meaningless remedies, right? Nobody ever wins, really. All you get is a remand to the agency, and then they'll get a do-over, and great. But there are some boundaries that they have drawn and can draw. I'm losing my train of thought, but so long as we expect an awful lot from government, okay, ain't nobody around except administrative agencies to do it, right? And so at the end of the day, it'll take a moment of occasional sobriety on the part of the American people to say, we get it, right? They can't do all of that stuff, right? And that's the only way to sort of bring some, I mean, to reimpose some limits, right? Without that sense, it's all systems go all the time, no matter what you do about Congress or the parties or the courts or anything, is my sense.
Well, picking up off of that last question, a question
on that cheerful note
from Slido, to what extent do the panelists believe that the West Virginia versus EPA ruling will force Congress to do its job and actually legislate rather than punt to the administrative state?
0%. But I mean, I think it was. I agree with the ruling. I'm not sure. I actually totally agree with its reading of the Clean Air Act, but. On the whole, I think if the administrative agency wants to assume jurisdiction over matters of great importance, like climate change, and to rewrite entire energy grids in light of some plan to deal with that problem, that Congress should probably clearly signal that it's giving the agency the authority to do that. I agree with that principle. But as far as what that's going to do on the other side to Congress, if you like the decision in Congress, you supported it. And if you don't like the decision, you oppose it. And it's not going to go back. Members of Congress are not going to now buckle down and really get to the question of what to do about climate change and to write a new statute. There's just no prospect of that happening as a result of the decision. The decision will have nothing to do with it if it happens.
I agree with that. I'll add one thing to it. It's important to remember how we got into this climate change stuff. In the first place. So there's a case, Massachusetts versus EPA in 2007, okay, where they say, whoa, CO2, it's a pollutant, right? Don't breathe. And so it can be regulated and must be regulated under the Clean Air Act. Nobody thought at the time that the Clean Air Act was actually built for climate change, for carbon dioxide and any other sort of greenhouse gas pollutant. The Clean Air Act is about local pollutants, not the atmosphere, for crying out loud, okay? The reason why they did that was plainly the expectation that, okay, there ain't no sentient human being in the country who thinks that the EPA can regulate this stuff under the Clean Air Act, therefore Congress has to do something. And Congress says, that's all very interesting. Go ahead, right? So it's tempting, and I think the chief thinks this way, that we'll cut you loose, go back to Congress, thank you very much. But Congress is just sitting there. What you are really struggling with, and what I'm trying to explain to my students is, you have to build an administrative law without Congress now. And that's a very, very hard thing to do.
Next question.
Hi, Michael Cozy, Catholic University, occasional writer for Newsmax. Not today, but quick question. I very much enjoyed your talk. You mentioned responsible party government, which has a really nifty, interesting ring from, I think, an APSA report from roughly 1950.
Yep.
I'm interested to get your opinion of that report and how it applies today, if that report is a viable way of reducing, as E.E. Schnatt-Sider would say, a semi-sovereign people reduced by the administrative agencies. Thank you very much.
Yeah, very good. So I 100% disagree with the APSA's, just in general. As a matter of principle, I tend to say I 100% disagree with anything that the APSA comes up with. That very famous report, Toward a Responsible Two-Party System, has it completely backwards, which is a responsible party government is one in which, it's a Wilsonian model of political parties, in which the parties are led from the top down by national leaders, basically the president, who then rewrites the parties into ideologically homogenous liberal, or say progressive and conservative parties in a kind of parliamentary kind of style. I defend the notion of responsible party government, but I use the term party responsibility the way that the old Republican Party used that term party responsibility during the progressive era. So if you go back and you read some of these debates, the most famous one is in 1910, when this whole system of party responsibility comes crumbling down. The Tsar Speaker faces a revolt. It's on St. Patrick's Day. This is Joseph Cannon. Most people know him because the office building is named after him on the Hill. He was a Tsar Speaker. And on St. Patrick's Day in 1910, a bunch of Republicans who don't like the fact that they have to listen to the party, they're all progressives, they don't like that the Republican Party leadership is not progressive, they introduce a resolution to strip him of power. Because the defenders of Cannon are out in the streets drinking, because it's St. Patrick's Day, there's a quorum in the House, but it's a quorum of a majority of which are Democrats who oppose Cannon and progressive Republicans. And so there's this three-day debate. The nation is transfixed while there's this revolt against the Speaker. And in the debates defending Cannon's leadership, the Tsar Speaker, they constantly refer to the notion of party responsibility. But what they mean by party responsibility is the party collectively responsible to the voters who sent them to Washington, D.C. In other words, it's not a top-down model, but a bottom-up model of parties representing the multiplicity of opinions that are part of their coalition. And the Speaker then is just the agent of that coalition. The Speaker doesn't dictate matters from on high. The Speaker is the agent of the people from the bottom up. That notion of responsible party government, I think, is firmly in the spirit of the Madisonian Constitution. The APSA reports is the attempt to graft a parliamentary style system on top of the separation of powers, and I think that is causing a lot of the problems we have today, actually, but will do much more damage than good.
Well, my name is Donald Devine. As an old professor of political science, I agree with you 100% on that. But kind of what I'm known for is the bureaucracy, which we didn't talk a lot about here. But the problem is, we had a lot of things working for us when we went in. The Civil Service Reform Act actually was a reform act Carter put through. It was by my former professor. When I went in there, he said to me, "You son of you're going to get all the benefits of what I did." But I went in again towards the end of the last administration, and it's so much worse. Almost all the good things have been taken out. So I want to emphasize, you're correct, that it can't be done by the president. It has to be done by Congress because it's been changed by Congress. And you're going to go to jail you don't. One thing else, Michael is right, we've changed over time, but I want to emphasize that here we did worry when we started this thing. Burnham, Kendall, Evan, Meyer, me, Morton always reminds me, have written on the importance of Congress. But my question is, you said you had reluctance about giving the power to committees. I don't see any other way of trying to straighten it out than to give the committees the powers that they're not picked by the speaker, basically. Go back to, why shouldn't we go back to seniority?
Maybe a different, so a third possibility. The problem with seniority is that it just means the interests, you know, sort of the suggestion is Dingell will always be senior and he'll always therefore be the chair. I mean, maybe you could have them, the chairs voted on by the party caucus or conference as a whole. So this way it's more bottom-up selection of the chairs rather than top-down. Seniority, I think my concern with that would be that the people who have seniority are the ones who best serve their constituents, and that's not always the best method for choosing the chairs of these kinds of committees.
I'll just add one thing. I mean, it would be useful to have your thoughts because you follow this stuff and I don't. I think you can have one of two views about sort of Congress and the committees. One is, why don't you people get together, form a committee, and at least have some oversight hearings over these agencies, right? Pay some attention to what they're actually doing. We can do that at least, can't we? That's one view. And the other view is that a Congress that can no longer legislate will also see its other powers from the purse to oversight atrophy, right? Because all you're going to get from, you know, calling an agency into Congress is a dog and pony show,
yeah,
right? They just blow steam. So at the end of the day, if you can't do anything to them by way of legislation or by way of at least budgetary controls, they're going to do whatever they want, right? Blow steam and, you know, say, thank you, we're not interested. So it's actually a sort of practically consequential question, it seems to me, because if you can't get a Congress that can get its act together legislating, doing real work like that, right, maybe it's the case that everything else will fall apart as well. Mm-hmm.
Another question from Slido. How has the cap on the number of seats in Congress, resulting in districts with massive populations, undermined the design of a multiplicity of factions?
The problem is that there you have two bad options, which is one is to create this problem, 750,000 constituents per district. The other is to double or triple the number of representatives in the House of Representatives. And neither of those options looks good to me. The latter option looks worse. Of course, this would be solved, as people have been mentioning, by reducing the scope of federal authority and returning power to the states, where the ratio of constituents to representative would be much better, because the size of the territory would be smaller. But as long as we can't solve that problem, I suppose I'm inclined to stick with the keep the districts large and the number of constituents per representative high rather than turning the House into a mob. So, you know, the famous essays in the Federalist Papers say, had every Athenian been a Socrates, every Athenian assembly would still have been a mob. Why? Because you get lots of people together in a supposedly deliberative body and all the deliberation breaks down. So 435 is probably where I'd want to stick for now. It is also, I guess, suppose just, you know, worth noting that the people who really want to increase the number of members of the House are not the kind of people who are here. They all, on the other side, think we will solve all of these problems. Their proposals, you know, are well known, right? Abolish the Senate, proportional representation, and then, you know, 1,000 members of the House of Representatives, and boom, you know, that changes everything for the progressives. So I guess as long as they're advocating increasing the number, I'm at least on that basis alone for keeping it where it is.
No matter what it is and who commenced it, I'm against it.
All right, we have time for one short question.
Okay. Thank you both very much. I'm Alex Taylor from the University of Dallas. So it seems that the separation of powers, right, ordered as it is towards the counteracting of ambition by ambition, right, in the words of Publius, requires that there actually be an appropriate ambition, right, in the different branches. And what I'm wondering is that it seems that in Congress, part of the problem is that we're lacking appropriate legislative ambition, right? Not that there's no ambition, that our congressmen are not ambitious in any way, but right, it's more of an ambition for political celebrity rather than actual legislative accomplishment.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering what can be done to encourage in potential legislators and in those we already have the adequate legislative ambition necessary. Thank you.
Terrific question.
Yes, yes.
And I should have said this earlier, and I thank you for the question because now I get to rail. one of Justice Jackson's points was that, was a Madisonian point. You have to, in order to make ambition counteract ambition, you have to connect the interests of the man with the rights of the place,
yes.
Right? For the president, that's a given,
right?
Because he's only one. Right, and he will, I mean, or she one day, I suppose, will defend the rights of the place because it's automatic. Mm-hmm. And for Congress, that is not a given, right? And so, I mean, we all know the slogans, right? You run for Congress by running against Congress, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The individual legislator's interests are very different from the place, the institution as such, right? And if you cannot find a way to reconnect the two, yeah, then you're really looking at a very grim future for Congress. And where I agree with Joe is, if you're looking for a way to reconnect the two, the parties, that has to be the answer.
So how do you reconnect the interest of a person to the place in Congress? We all know they run for Senate so that they can run for president. Honor the Senate, honor Congress. We don't honor the institution anymore, and so we don't honor the people who serve in it. So why would they want to serve in it? How does it advance their ambition if they're going to be dishonored for serving in that body? Now maybe it's worthy of being dishonored, but we shouldn't be surprised at the outcome, which is, if it's seen as a dishonorable place, why would people who have ambition want to serve in it rather than see it as a means to another end?
Excellent. Well, I see the red light is on, so please join me in thanking our panelists.